when God decided to love you, he wasn't content to sort of love you at a distance. He wanted to get up close when that happened, which is why Christ took on human flesh.
Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire talking about his presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
But even after Christ ascended to the right hand of the Father, God still wanted to dwell with you through the flesh and blood of his Son. He wanted to be physically present and in the room when he covered you in forgiveness and life and salvation. So that's why he's given his church the Lord's Supper, and that's why we should rejoice every time God comes into the room and invites us to feast on the same flesh and the same blood that won our salvation at Calvary.
You can meet and hear Pastor Hans Feeney making the case for the Lord's Supper at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
You've probably heard of Scientology. In fact, every 6 seconds, someone searches the question, what is Scientology? We want to answer your questions. Because frankly, whatever you have heard, if you haven't heard it from us, I can assure you, we are not what you expect.
I don't know other churches that demand to destroy people's lives if they leave and speak out publicly against it. I don't know real churches who demand families to break apart if one feels that they should leave the church, and their policies actually mandate to destroy people's lives. It actually has doctrine that says find out what's important to them and go after it. It's vile behavior, and this is, I have to remind people, an organization calling itself a church.
That's David Miscavige. He's called the chairman of the board of the Church of Scientology, the public face, along with those many celebrities who are Scientologists, of this, what do you call it, a religion, a cult, a secret society, and Leah Remini, who is probably one of the most famous ex-Scientologists. She's spent a lot of time over the last several years exposing not only her experiences in Scientology, but many other people's experiences there as well. Is Scientology a religion? Is it a cult? Is it a secret society? What did L. Ron Hubbard come up with when he came up with this idea of Dianetics and Scientology? What is the object of a Scientologist's faith? And what do they do with Jesus of Nazareth? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the beliefs and practices of the Church of Scientology, Dr. Jeff Mallinson. He's professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, California, author of a chapter on Scientology in the book The Christian Difference. Dr. Mallinson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The big question I think a lot of people have struggled with is Scientology actually a religion?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the fun part and also the frightening part of the whole study of this thing called Scientology is that there was a community that surrounded L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, who had been a science fiction writer and pretty well known. And one of his friends was a guy named Robert Heinlein, and he wrote a book called Stranger in a Strange Land. And it's about a guy from Mars who comes, and part of the novel involves the creation of a religion. And as Hubbard started to think about it, he was said to have exclaimed, wait a minute, this is good. This is going to be much more money. You know, starting a religion is going to be much more lucrative than, you know, writing these cheap fiction books. And so in that sense, it is kind of a scam. I mean, and I think most, you know, good journalistic work has shown that this is the case. Early on, he wrote to a friend who was working with him that if they could get the religion angle going, this would allow them government protections, tax breaks, and so forth, and it would allow them to do the work that they would have been in trouble for doing because they were kind of doing kind of pseudo-scientific counseling work, and they would have been in trouble, and then they just called it religion. At the same time, there's all sorts of ways in which things in society that we would call secular ideologies, I would even argue pyramid schemes themselves, can take the form of a religion, especially for people who are lost and detached from traditional forms of spirituality and faith.
Is Scientology a secret society in the sociological sense?
It certainly plays to what we call the Gnostic itch, that idea that there is something that I'm going to know and that you're going to share with me, and that secretive knowledge is exactly what motivates people. It's not an effective one to the extent that you see even other lodges and groups maybe having more of that camaraderie that they might say they would enjoy. I suppose there's a camaraderie, but it's a much different thing in Scientology. But yeah, the thing that motivates people to stay in it is that idea that if they just stick around longer, they're going to get the deep secrets of the universe. And we all like that idea that we might have something that other people don't know.
Is it a cult?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an academic, and I know that in the world of religious studies, it's not fashionable to talk about anybody as being a cult. And largely, this is, I think, an oversensitivity on the part of academics, especially in the social sciences, where the idea is if any new religious group comes up, of course, the established forms in the world religions are going to call it a cult. And so it's pejorative. It's a negative term. But I've been thinking, especially as I was doing the research for this particular chapter, that we really do need to recover the term, almost even the term culty as an adjective. Because when we were trying over the years as academics to be cautious and be responsible and respectful of different religious groups, we also tended to play down the deep harm and really the criminal behavior of some of these groups. What we used to, you know, think about is brainwashing and this sort of thing. You know, part of it is in the 70s, a lot of families started to try to get their children, their adult children, out of these groups that we call cults, and they're very dangerous organizations. And yet we have a principle in the United States that, well, you've got the right to your own religion. And so it became very difficult for folks to find a way to help their loved ones get out of these kind of groups. But, you know, is Scientology a cult? It's the paradigmatic cult. It is, I think, worth studying, not so much because it's attractive to people anymore. I think there's been enough to expose it. I think what's really important about it is that by understanding what happened with Scientology, we can, I think, get a better understanding of other ways in which new cults might arise, and it'll be easier for us to spot some of those same tactics. But yeah, the paradigmatic cult.
What do we know just in terms of the size, the numerical size of Scientology in terms of membership?
Well, this is where it's incredibly difficult for academics to get any clear numbers. I'm absolutely convinced that they are in the tens of thousands, and they tend to advertise, you know, incredibly inflated numbers, and they can be so inflated that we're not even in the ballpark. The reason they do this is because it helps them to cover up the fact that they've got a lot of money and a lot of property and nothing's really going on inside these buildings. And what this does for them is it allows them to have all of those protections as an IRS classified religion. And it gives people the sense that this is legitimate, even though behind the scenes there are just a very few number of people that are in power or that are going to get the benefits from all of this wealth. But they have a lot of buildings, they have a lot of publications, and they inflate those intentionally to make them look like more of a reasonably respected and legitimate sort of religion.
Can you explain that the penchant for real estate, I guess other than just financial investment, these buildings that are renovated on the first floor and then stand empty, gutted, on all the other floors? Can you explain that?
It's partly that the whole thing is built on this desire for success and mattering and meaning, and you've got the Hollywood folks and everybody. If you had a small little operation, that certainly wouldn't sell. So in one way, they're taking the money that they extract, large amounts of money from people that want to get clear, they want to be healed. And as they extract all this money, they need to put it somewhere. But secondly, they need to put it somewhere that gives them the appearance of legitimacy so that they can go get more money and get more support from folks that maybe, like in Hollywood, don't know all the dirty details, or at least didn't until more recently.
You say that Scientology presents a paradox to those who are trying to study it from the outside. What do you mean by that?
Well, if I had a group of students in Southern California who wanted to study the rise of a toxic new religion, it's right here. It's in our backyard. It's this the field work that could be done, and the amount of interesting twists and turns that are very recent and they're documented. We just have so much knowledge about what they've been up to. On the other hand, there is a way in which, because it's recent, they have copyright lawsuits very often for anybody who wants to quote it. So if I want to cite the Quran, if I want to cite, you know, some rabbinic texts, I can, with my students, give them a very good sense of what the primary sources of this religion are. But the official external publications of Scientology, while they're free and all over the place and on the web, they don't really get to the heart of what's going on. And for that, you have to go to material that is controversial, contested by the religion itself, and sometimes, in fact, in many cases, dangerous to publish. And you will very likely get hassled as you're poking around with some of this stuff. And so because of that, you don't have, you know, community college classes on this. I mean, it is a kind of a nerve-wracking sort of, it's a nerve-wracking sort of thing to explore. And I was a little bit nervous myself to take it on.
So how would you describe the basic message of Scientology?
The basic message is a kind of scientific religious amalgamation. You know, it's born in this 20th century desire to feel like you've got something that matters, some spirituality, maybe not so much dogma, and a technology. And that's what they offered. They said, hey, we've got a religious technology, and what we're going to do is we're going to help you to understand the nature of your traumas and the reason you suffer. And for them, the reason you suffer is that you have these things, these recorded engrams, these little bits of thing that have mass in your body. And you get them through childhood trauma, perhaps a past life trauma. But the idea is, let's say, you know, your folks are fighting while you're in the womb. You're going to pick up these negative, almost like little, maybe not so intelligent demons that are in your body. And then the Scientologists will give you two nice little metallic bars to hold on to, and they will be able to have a scientific way of getting rid of your pain, and in Christian terms, your sin. So you can then watch as the little needle moves, and it's almost like confession and absolution. They're recording these counseling sessions. These really are kind of private confessions of your sins. And as you go over them and over them, you start to become desensitized to the pain that they cause, and you feel, or you're supposed to feel, liberated. You are moving towards total freedom and ultimately a kind of godlike existence.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Mallinson, professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, California, and author of a chapter on Scientology in the book The Christian Difference, about the beliefs and practices of Scientology. We'll talk about L. Ron Hubbard, its founder, after this.
In the family of God, we never run out of people to love. This line from Robert Zagore's article, Who is My Neighbor?, cuts to the heart of the Lutheran Witness's February issue on mercy. Beginning with the earliest Christians and carrying the story forward to present-day mercy work in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, this issue will open eyes to Christ's great love for the church and the church's great love for a world in need. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
Public schools are increasingly chaotic and undermine Christian children's faith. We need to rebuild our Lutheran schools to provide a truly Christian alternative. Redeemer Classical School is rebuilding this Christ-focused education in Fort Wayne, Indiana, teaching students to wonder at God's creation and to love their neighbors. We need you to help us give children this faithful Christian education. Donations to Redeemer Classical School go directly to providing scholarships. Visit fortwayneclassical.com/give.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship.
We're talking about the beliefs and practices of the Church of Scientology. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Jeff Mallinson is our guest, author of a chapter on Scientology in the book The Christian Difference. Dr. Mallinson, L. Ron Hubbard was a very interesting and unusual person. He's the founder of Scientology, its inventor, as you pointed out. What do we know about him?
Well, he's, you know, we probably all know somebody like this who tells these really wild tales, a kind of compulsive liar that is, you're almost embarrassed for them because the wildness of their stories just kind of increases with its incredulity. But he has a pretty clear pattern of his narrative. He's always trying to create a sense of who he was that was bigger than reality. He was, in many ways, I think, somebody who believed somewhere along the line that he could create his own reality, or that he could speak a certain kind of reality into existence. And so at one level, I think he knew that he was a fraud on some of the stories that he would tell. But on another level, I think he believed that if he truly believed in these stories that he told, then in a way that he would create this universe and it would be real. Now, this goes, it goes back to what he started to try to do, which was more in the realm of the occult. In my backyard, there was the actual rocket scientist, Jack Parsons. He was a he was working in a lab, but he was also into the occult, and he was a fan of Aleister Crowley. And yet, Aleister Crowley didn't really trust him, and it didn't end up trusting L. Ron Hubbard. But Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard went out into the desert in Southern California, and they tried to bring about the end of the world, the Beast of Babylon, and they found a red-haired woman to help them make this happen. And they had this strange liturgy, they sacrificed some things, they had Jack Parsons was going to write down what L. Ron Hubbard would get from an underworld spirit, some kind of prophecies about how to bring on the end of the world. And so before Scientology, Hubbard was trying to create a religion. But that one was just a little too crazy for people, I think, to embrace. And I think they, at some point, you know, had to have a falling out because Jack Parsons' ex-girlfriend and L. Ron Hubbard tried to scam Jack Parsons. And they went to the East Coast to get a bunch of old sailboats. And then they were going to use this for their project, essentially for their Antichrist. Ultimately, then Hubbard got the idea to just sail off with the girlfriend and the boats and not turn them into him. So the breakup of that relationship between Hubbard and Parsons forced Hubbard to go back to the drawing board and create maybe a little bit more of a tame kind of religion.
How do Scientologists regard Hubbard?
You know, he's kind of like combination of a Kim Jong-un, like a dictator on the one hand, and a prophet on the other. But he was the thing that held it all together for a while, even though in many ways he was absent for most of the formative aspects of Scientology's development. He was really on the run from the law. He was being investigated by several governments, and so he was, you know, getting that captain hat on, and he was out on the high seas, so he would be in international waters. So he's more of the face that you would see up on some big event, and somebody that is revered. And of course, he is the guy who wrote essentially all their scriptures. So he's their prophet, but he's also kind of like that, you know, if you think about one of those dictators that has their face everywhere around town, that's also kind of the culture.
To the present day, what do we know about this man, David Miscavige, who is the current, I don't even know what to call him. Do you call him a leader?
Yeah, so he became the leader of the whole thing, and he is the dictator of the group. I mean, he is calling all the shots. They call him the COB, the chairman of the board. He's the chairman of the board of the religious technology aspect of the religion. So they might have people that kind of serve to make it look like they're a real religion. They have chaplains sometimes, and they might have people that look like pastors. But the real shots are called by David Miscavige, because he is in charge of making sure everyone is using the technology properly. And if you don't use the technology properly, or if you use an older version of it, you're called a squirrel. You are not allowed to operate as a practitioner, like a church worker, without going exactly through the materials that he releases. And so part of that is to just ensure that you have to always be updating your library. They'll get a new edition, and that's the one you have to use. But he's really, I think, I was trying to be generous to Hubbard. Hubbard is a pitiable character in some ways, even though it was clearly a fraudulent and abusive, but he's kind of like that kid who didn't really feel good about himself, so he kind of goes on to create this wild story and maybe gets out of hand. David Miscavige is, by all accounts, a pretty toxic narcissist. And most of the people that have, in the last few decades, left Scientology have left because of his very tyrannical behavior. And the allegations are that he is pretty fond of physically abusing even high-ranking officials under in his downline. And so, as I say this, it's nerve-wracking because, you know, most of what I've done in my life has been to research and write about things that happened, you know, 500 years ago. And so if the Calvinists don't like my take on the debate between the Lutherans and the Calvinists at the colloquy of Montbéliard, they're not really around to be too miffed about it. But here's a guy who lives, you know, 50, 60 minutes from my house, and so that's a nerve-wracking thing. And in fact, it is in many ways his tactics that keep, I think, some of the more high-profile folks, the Hollywood sorts, in the organization, because they know that if you cross this guy, it is not going to go. It's not going to go smoothly for you.
How do Scientologists regard him? Is he on the same level with L. Ron Hubbard in their minds?
That's a really hard question to answer, because there really can only be two ways that you would relate to him. One, in fear, you would concede your own will and critical thinking. So, folks, I would argue probably his wife, we don't really know where she is, but I think the best explanation is she has been kind of in her mind. I guess the word really is brainwashed, but if you were to go up and ask her if she wants to leave the cult, she would probably say no. But this is also hard to know for sure what they're thinking, because they're so terrified of David Miscavige. Those who leave recognize that that's something that most people are uncomfortable with within the organization. But it is a relationship of fear. And I think that for the folks that I've talked to that are ex-Scientologists, there are some times when they do have a fondness still for L. Ron Hubbard. And some even say that what Hubbard taught, at least in terms of the way we can find peace in life, they think it still works. They think that the basic message of Scientology in Dianetics, for instance, the auditing, that that's a helpful thing. And I suppose it's helpful for the same reason that people find private confession helpful, right? It's not a new thing. But for the most part, when you get to David Miscavige, there isn't that fondness. not really for folks who are in it, and definitely not for folks on the way out. It really is, I think, somebody who's largely running the thing out of fear.
What is the Sea Organization?
So the Sea Org is where you get a lot of the more nefarious stories. If you met a Scientologist, let's say, who was, you know, a writer in Hollywood, they might not really know what's going on behind the scenes. They think they've been helped by the network of people that are Scientologists in Hollywood, and maybe they know a little bit about some of the weird stuff going on, but generally they're all right with it. The Sea Org is where things get very difficult for the members. It's kind of an elite team of folks who sign up for a billion-year contract, but very often it's young people who are looking for meaning. And so when they get into this organization was, for much of its existence, actually on a boat, on this ship that L. Ron Hubbard, he was a captain of it. And so that was where all of his attendants would be. And so these Sea Org members are basically his elite guard, his elite task force. They do what he tells them to do, or that's what it was for Hubbard. And so it continues to this day. They don't always have to be on a vessel. They have operations in California and Florida. But it's the group that does the inside work for the leader.
We're talking with Jeff Mallinson, professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He's author of a chapter on Scientology in the book called The Christian Difference. When we come back, we're going to talk about Hubbard's writings, films, lectures. What role do they play for Scientologists? Are you looking for a new devotional resource in 2019? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During February, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Perry Lutheran Homes. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
The Lord is our shepherd, and we are the people of his pasture. Why then do we still suffer in this life? Disease, loneliness, persecution. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm collaborating with Cheryl Swope, Molly Hemingway, and a host of literary friends in He Restores My Soul, a book that takes an honest look at hardship and heartache in light of God's promises found in his word. He Restores My Soul is now available at emmanuelpress.us. emmanuelpress.us.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, February the 26th, we're talking about the beliefs and practices of the Church of Scientology. Dr. Jeff Mallinson is our guest. Dr. Mallinson, L. Ron Hubbard's writings, also I think his films and his lectures, what role do they play in Scientology?
So of course, first and foremost, they inform the body of Scientologists what the teachings are, right? This is what you study. And if you're in the Sea Org, for instance, you're going to spend countless hours studying these writings, and there are so many of them, and his lectures, and the recordings of those, and so on the one hand, they serve as the scriptures of the religion, if you'll call it that. On the other hand, they are the thing that actually keeps this beast going, which is the sale of these materials. So once you get started in it, you are encouraged to and sometimes coerced to by continual updates of L. Ron Hubbard materials. And the fact is, there's such a vast library that even if you just got every adherent to buy the books in addition to the auditing fees, it's going to be a very lucrative operation. And that's partly why it's so dangerous, because they have the ability to hire private investigators and people that would go out and intimidate folks. They don't have a lot of manpower within the Church of Scientology, but they have the ability to hire maybe questionable characters on the outside of the organization to do their dirty work.
What is the object of a Scientologist's faith?
Now, I want to go back and say that as much as the therapeutic element is something that they tend to embrace, I still want to make sure it's very clear to the listeners that the object of their faith is hard for them sometimes to articulate, because it's the theology is a front for the money-making scheme, if I can be blunt about it. It's like, as much as I want to research and read and get into all the fine points of the creation myth of Scientologists, it's not what they talk about very often. It's not the sort of thing that is really for the insider. It's almost for university libraries, so that you could go in and say, well, what do they teach? What are their beliefs? The idea that it's got a doctrine that really is what animates the Scientologist, that idea is something that they might want to project to the outsider, but ultimately I don't think is very much the central matter of importance. But I think what is important is that kind of deification, that there's a way in which the Scientologist is promised that they will matter, they will heal the world, they'll make it a better place, but they also, in doing this, will essentially become deified. They will be connected up with this concept of the kind of principle of the universe, this theta. And so it got a little bit of that Eastern religious sensibility to it.
You had mentioned the creation myth. What does Scientology teach about creation?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because they don't like a godless evolution, a purposeless kind of evolution. They do believe in reincarnation, a long period of time, and the development of what they call MEST, M-E-S-T, matter, energy, space, and time. And so there's an intelligent designer, and it's the power of this, almost like the Holy Spirit would be Theta, but it's not really a personal deity. And in no way do you see a devotion to God, a personal relationship with God. These aren't things that they talk about even really in their public materials. It's really about understanding the way in which knowing what this intelligent design and this creative principle behind matter, energy, space, and time is, when you understand it, then you can channel that power, and then you yourself can, like I said, be kind of like a god, because you are now able to have that intelligent design's energy. But again, it's not like there's a creative, loving God that's creating the world as we know it.
What does Scientology then teach about man and his condition?
It's kind of this channeling of the Christian idea of sin without having sin. What do I mean? He's not an Augustinian, right? They don't believe in original sin. They believe that humans are basically good, and that their job or what they want is to survive, and that the spirit can be saved. And yet the part that they keep that Christians have is the idea that you have now, even though you're basically good, or you're not maybe born with original sin, you do happen to have these body thetans. And so you have the problem of, or you have the advantage if you're a Scientologist, of having identified an illness in people that they need you to extract. But they also have that kind of 20th century optimism about human beings. So human nature, basically good.
What do they teach about ethics?
They have some documents that will give you the sense that they believe in just a general being good, you know, treating others as you want them to treat you. But the part that's, I think, more dangerous about Scientology and ethics is that ultimately they have really no moral compass other than what they're told to do for the sake of the religion. So everything ethically boils down to serving Scientology itself. Everything is about promoting and protecting Scientology. So if you have to lie for Scientology, that's ethical. If you have to break somebody down emotionally through all sorts of tactics, psychological tactics, that's the right thing to do. If you have to extort or bully IRS officials, police officers, academics, it's the right thing to do. In other words, you know, I'm sure at the first surface level, they have a fine enough set of ethical principles that are pretty standard, you know, kind of Ten Commandments kind of stuff without the first table. But behind it is an absolute authoritarian view of what right and wrong is. It's whatever the organization says.
Does that help explain part of what you were describing before? That is why Scientology has proven to be so litigious with both its own wayward members and even outsiders.
Yeah. So not only will they get litigious, but they will invent stuff. They will create websites that they look like it would be the person that they're smearing, and they'll put nasty stuff up about them. But then if you were even to say something that is factual and documented, you could get, you know, threatened with a lawsuit. And they do this because from the very beginning, this was in the culture. L. Ron Hubbard said that anybody who's outside, anybody who is a suppressive person, it's what they called fair game. And today, they deny that the policy of fair game is still in effect. Fair game was a policy set forward by L. Ron Hubbard that said that basically, if anybody is attacking the religion or its leaders, then they're entirely fair game. You can do whatever you want to them, and that would be a good thing. And the leadership and the universe would be glad you did.
You used the word a moment ago, authoritarian. What do you mean by that, and how is Scientology, as you say in your chapter, it is and it isn't authoritarian?
It's most definitely authoritarian in its culture, in that when you look at, or when sociologists or psychologists look at authoritarian personality, they'll note that it can sometimes look like you are dominating other people, but it also can mean that you are unwaveringly enslaved or a dutiful servant. So therefore, it's possible, for instance, that David Miscavige would have been a perfectly dutiful servant to the leadership of Scientology in his young life. But then once he became the chairman of the board, he then lorded it over others. So that's throughout the culture. And there is that sense then of setting aside your critical thought and trusting entirely in your upline, the folks that are above you. But, you know, if an authoritarian is at work and always saying yes to the boss and feeling kind of small, when they get home, they might be abusive to their spouse or their dog. Whoever is beneath them is going to get that same kind of abusive behavior. And so there were many accounts. Former Scientologists have said that even though they recognized there were very bad actions and physically abusive actions on the part of David Miscavige, they sometimes took part in it themselves, and they had a great sense of guilt. But that was part of the culture, and it was passed on down as it would trickle down to lower levels and lower ranks.
Dr. Jeff Mallinson is our guest, author of a chapter on Scientology in the book called The Christian Difference. We're talking about the beliefs and practices of the Church of Scientology. When we come back, does Scientology have worship practices? And if so, what are they? Stay tuned.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc. St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
That's why He picked up His cross, to which He would be nailed, so great His love for us. And that's why willingly we pick up our own. Amen.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the beliefs and practices of the Church of Scientology with Dr. Jeff Mallinson. A little bit later, we'll spend some time with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about a New York Times op-ed column titled, Why the Priesthood Needs Women. Then Mark Tooley will bring us up to date on the General Conference of the United Methodist Church meeting in St. Louis. Dr. Mallinson, let's turn to worship practices. Does Scientology have them? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, there are a couple that I would say are more like a front. They have services that are intended to look like Christian services. The symbol that you see if you're in LA, you're driving past a building, it has a kind of cross to it. That's not the one that they tend to use for the most part in their own stuff, but on the outside of buildings, it makes it look like it's a church, and they have at times had pastors who would wear clerical collars. But no, the worship is really worship of the leader and worship ultimately of self and success, because for the most part, people get into it because they want to be like John Travolta and Tom Cruise and Beck. These are people in the entertainment industry that are successful. They are little g gods, and that's what they want to be. And so on a day-to-day basis, devotion, worship, chanting psalms, that's not the kind of thing they're doing.
Then what does salvation look like? I mean, you've described maybe the overall goal, but is salvation the right word to use? What does it look like in Scientology?
Well, they're definitely selling a kind of salvation, and I think it's fair to call it that. You're being saved from these negative traumas and these bad types of thought, these lower frequencies. And salvation, although you don't know anybody who's really gotten all the way through and been able to do what L. Ron Hubbard promised, but salvation ultimately looks like somebody who has perfect memory, who is a perfected being, doesn't do bad things anymore, doesn't have bad habits, has their sexualities, you know, squared right, and ultimately then somebody who gets supernatural powers. So salvation is saving you from your delusion, if I want to use more of like a Buddhist way of thinking about it, saving you from your delusion that keeps you from the divine powers that you have. And if you could just go through what they call the bridge to total freedom at the top of the level, you'll be like, you know, Thor, you know, in the sense that you're up there in some kind of different realm. And even for L. Ron Hubbard, there is a life beyond the grave and reincarnation, but for them it's this idea that at the very top of the thing you can be like a god.
Just as an aside, do you think that helps explain one of the most famous Scientologists, Tom Cruise, who is at least in his film work famous for refusing stunt doubles? He insists on doing these things, putting his life at serious risk. Life and limb. And I've often wondered, why would someone who has so much to lose in terms of worldly wealth want to chance it unless he believes that he's on his way toward superpowers?
Todd, that's incredibly astute. And it does make, I never thought about that, because it's, well, David Miscavige and Tom Cruise love to ride really powerful motorcycles. I ride motorcycles, but what they ride are very, very terrifying machines, and they do care about themselves. They're kind of narcissistic. I think that there is a part of them. I think it's what you're mentioning here, I think, is a little bit of evidence that there is a part of them that really does believe in their own rhetoric and their own story. You would kind of have to, right? I mean, it's a very attractive thing that you're essentially the head prophet. And yeah, they don't, I don't think they fear too many things in that regard. They don't fear disease, theoretically, if you can get to the higher level. So that would make a lot of sense.
What does Scientology do with Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, in the public rhetoric, they try to say that Jesus was, you know, a great moral teacher. But in the private stuff, the private letters, and in some of the lectures from L. Ron Hubbard, he denigrates Jesus. He says some pretty blasphemous stuff about him. I don't have the quotations offhand, but that was something early on. And I think it goes with the idea that Jesus is too weak for L. Ron Hubbard. He doesn't ask for enough. There's a part of the Brothers Karamazov called the Grand Inquisitor, and the idea is that Jesus is now undergoing questioning with the Spanish Inquisition, and they're kind of angry at Jesus. The Inquisitor is angry with Jesus for not taking the kingdoms of the world, not bowing down before Satan and taking the kingdom in that way. And so in a similar way, L. Ron Hubbard wanted Scientology to take over the world, to take over governments, to be something that the United States would use in the Cold War to oppose the Soviets. And so Jesus was just too nice for L. Ron Hubbard. He didn't have the kind of guts and the hustle that he thought he had.
Talk about some famous former Scientologists.
Well, the one, of course, it's in the news now is Leah Remini, who's now, I think, on her third season. But the third season was cut short because of some of the legal battles they were having related to Danny Masterson, who is a current Scientologist and has some allegations against him. The others that I think are more interesting, or I'm not saying that Leah Remini's story is not interesting, but are the family members. For instance, the father of David Miscavige has come out and written a book about his escaping. Kind of a funny story for him. He was given for a present a Kindle, but most Scientologists in the inner circles were given computer filters that would filter out any negative information about Scientology. So they just didn't know some of the really weird stuff and the weird allegations. So David Miscavige's dad, when he got this Kindle, they didn't turn off the internet. So just doing his daily Bible study, you know, which is not really a Bible, but reading the materials, he went to Google some of it, and he all of a sudden got this whole flood of new information. So he's been an interesting person to kind of share what's the inner workings of it. But I think Mike Rinder is one of the more interesting Scientologists. He's not famous for anything other than being a former Scientologist, but he was so close to all of the nasty tactics that his testimony and his experiences, I think, are the most insightful, most revealing. And he has been working closely with Leah Remini on her show to, you know, kind of expose all the various facets of Scientology and its bad behavior.
I have interviewed former Scientologists, and most of the time it's just tragic horror stories of how they were mistreated and things like that, because largely in Sea Org. What have you learned in your discussions with Scientologists and former Scientologists?
Yeah, well, almost every one of them started with something that I understand, the desire to know what the meaning of life is. They want to be a part of something that matters. They want to be a part of something that changes the world. So they always kind of start there and just end up in this, as you say, very painful, tragic experience. And then perhaps the most frightening part is the getting out, and the way that is both difficult to do, especially for, like you said, members of the Sea Org, but also difficult once you're out. I'm fascinated by all sorts of folks who have to, you know, they leave their cults and then they find something very dangerous, which is the despair of not knowing if there's any meaning at all. And they don't know if they can trust anything. People, certainly religious teachers, you know. And they often have problems with depression and suicide. The, you know, FLDS, the Fundamentalist Mormons, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints have this problem. Ex-Amish kids have this problem. If they leave the community, they don't know anything besides what they've been taught in these schools, and they're usually just taught stuff about L. Ron Hubbard, and that's not very helpful for, let's say, going on into business. So they're really cut adrift. And the thing, though, that I think I've also been nervous about is the number of them, as I said, who still have to kind of hang on to all that they invested in it. It's very hard for us to release something that we spent all that time and energy on. But for them, they spent a lot of money. And so they sometimes, I think, in an unhealthy way, will communicate with me that they really still believe the theology. They just think that the current leadership is misguided. Some, of course, then go the other direction and just say, no, I don't want anything to do with religion at all. I'm just so embarrassed that I was duped into that, and so I'm never going to be duped again. So you can't really talk to them about Jesus in any way other than just some of the basic teachings about loving your neighbor.
You say that Scientology represents a characteristically 20th century American type of new religion. What do you mean by that, Dr. Mallinson?
You know, there was a time, I think, when people really did believe, I think it was kind of in the 70s in the academy, they believed that we were moving towards an era of secularism in the way that they meant it, which was that there would be no more need for the superstition of believing in God or believing in religion. And after 9/11, 2001, religious scholars changed their tune because they realized that human beings are very religious. But Americans want a couple things. They want, first of all, to feel like they're being scientific. Science is the new priesthood. So if they can find something that has scientific terminology, makes sense of the idea of space travel, all of this is part of the narrative and the myth, then they can also feel like what they're doing is rational and reasonable. And that's the weird irony of this thing. They go into it thinking this is the most scientifically reasonable, the most rational religion to be a part of. And it forces you ultimately to completely check your mind at the door. The second thing that people want is a sense of success. So that individual spirit, that American desire to, yes, be part of a community and a group, but also to matter in a way that brings you fame and fortune. And so you've got both of those things. You package that in the name of religion, and that's very attractive for people in the 20th century. Anybody who's going to get a self-help book is going to, at least to some extent, have been attracted to the sorts of things that L. Ron Hubbard was selling and that Scientologists do sell today. I don't want to play it down so much to say that this isn't a threat in terms of people getting roped in. I just think that many of these things that, again, we can rightly call cults, are having a difficult time these days. I know that, the Jehovah's Witnesses have a similar problem, which is in the old days when people would give you something, that might be all you would know about it, their materials, a book. Here's the Book of Mormon. Here's Dianetics. Here's a pamphlet from the Watchtower Society. Now, young people and old can just go on their iPhone and just quickly research these things, and you see how weird it is. And they're having a very difficult time getting young people in. What's not going to be difficult are new forms of religion that look like Scientology but take a different shape in the digital internet age. They're going to have to find a way to sell their weirdness online, and they can't just rely on pamphlets and booklets that are going to be debunked on the internet. So it's a very dangerous group. I'm surprised that they still have the clout to be able to push back against people with Hollywood money too, but they do, and they are around, and they are in many ways emblematic of the weirdness that was the 20th century American religious experience.
Dr. Jeff Mallinson is professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He's author of a chapter on Scientology in the book, The Christian Difference. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand or call Concordia Publishing House. Ask for The Christian Difference, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Mallinson, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Peter Scare will be with us on the other side of the break. We'll get his response to a New York Times op-ed column titled, Why the Priesthood Needs Women. It's arguing the same logic that has
moved the Roman Catholic Church to refuse ordination to women has produced the priestly abuse crisis. Stay tuned. What's the difference between brokenness and repentance? I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Personal Brokenness. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Alfonso Espinosa writes about being raised a nominal Roman Catholic and finding the saving gospel in the Lutheran confession. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
My kind of town, Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a faithful Lutheran church in East Central Oklahoma? Welcome to Trinity Okmulgee, a friendly and faithful LCMS congregation only 40 miles south of Tulsa. Hi, this is Pastor Chris Teebs. Check us out at trinityokmulgee.org. That's Trinity, O-K-M-U-L-G-E-E, all one word, .org. See you soon at Trinity Okmulgee, Oklahoma.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.